As a small business, we have always prioritized our underwriting for an HPR as one of the primary marketing investments that we make.
Jim Fitz, Managing Director of the Colony Group, a longtime business supporter of NHPR.
We find that our clients appreciate that support, and also we frequently hear that NHPR is where they first hear our name.
You can learn more on how to reach NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. What does it mean to recover from COVID-19? For some people, it's a few days or weeks. But over this past year, we've learned that this virus can have significant long-term impacts for others, and not just those who require hospitalization. Some patients, even with mild initial symptoms, also find themselves dealing with health issues for weeks, even months, after they were first diagnosed, from breathing troubles to neurological problems. Today in The Exchange, what we know and what we don't about the impacts of COVID-19 long after infection. And listeners, if you have questions about this or you've experienced it yourself, give us a call. It's 800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, or again, the number 800-892-6477. We're talking with Dr. Jason Maley. He's a pulmonary and critical care physician at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston and a researcher and teacher at Harvard Medical School and MIT. He's the director of the Beth Israel Critical Illness and COVID-19 Survivorship Program, where he studies patients who've survived stays in intensive care and survivors of COVID-19. Dr. Maley, a big welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Dr. David Kaminsky. He's a pulmonary and critical care physician at the University of Vermont Medical Center and medical director of the Pulmonary Function Laboratory. He also works with long-term COVID patients. And Dr. Kaminsky, a big welcome to you too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, both of you, when COVID-19 data is reported, you know, it's largely around two data points: number of cases, number of deaths. What stories and struggles about the patients that you both see does that focus on just those two numbers leave out? And Dr. Maley, I'll turn to you first, please.
Yeah, sure. I think what they leave out and what we're talking about today is that after people recover from the initial feeling of sickness, the fevers and the other symptoms that they're having, many patients are left with these lingering issues that really impact their quality of life. And prior to COVID-19, people experienced these things after being sick in the ICU, but they weren't often addressed. And so I think that's the big piece here, is what patients are experiencing that is impairing them from returning to their life, from returning to work, and not necessarily captured by just saying that they survived.
That's interesting. So this focus now on post-COVID syndrome, some people are calling it, Dr. Maley, may have implications for other long-term symptoms, symptoms that linger even after people are quote-unquote cured. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. I think so. For me, a lot of the focus is on people who have been in the intensive care unit, but all of these long COVID symptoms are also happening in people who didn't have to be hospitalized when they were first sick. And after the ICU, we've known for a while that patients have really severe lingering issues with their thinking, their memory, their strength, and their mental health. And despite knowing that, there weren't a lot of programs to address this. And COVID has kind of been a spark to get people around the world and certainly hospitals tuned into the idea of treating patients beyond just the sudden initial illness, with the focus that it's not just about surviving, but about returning to your life and doing the things that you enjoy most.
Well, and later on, we'll hear from a COVID-19 long-term survivor who has started a support group for the many people like her. But what do you think, Dr. Kaminsky, about this point? You know, we focus so much on number of infections, number of deaths, end of story, and there's a lot of stories that are left out of that.
Well, I totally agree with Dr. Maley. That's exactly our experience here as well. The numbers give us the statistics day by day, but what's left out of that, of course, is the story of the human behind the numbers. And as he said, we're not only seeing people who had sort of pre-existing conditions that are now further brought to light, but we're also seeing really devastatingly healthy people, hikers, athletes, fully functioning young people who are now left with lingering symptoms in many cases. And it totally changes their quality of life. It's extremely frustrating, and it causes a lot of emotional distress. So the numbers are important. They guide us in terms of policy. They give us hope when they're getting better. We get worried when they're getting worse. But behind all that is the stories of the patients themselves. And it's estimated about 10%, and probably that's an underestimate, of people are developing these lingering long symptoms that are really affecting their quality of life.
Well, and Dr. Kaminsky, what stands out for you when it comes to treating these patients who, you know, initially, hurrah, they've recovered, but then it turns out maybe not so much?
Well, in my own experience being a lung specialist, we're seeing a lot of patients in our clinic who continue to have shortness of breath or chest pain. And many of these patients first presented back in March or April. And by the time they see me, typically they've had an X-ray. Sometimes they've had an echocardiogram to look at their heart to make sure it's okay. They might have had a CAT scan to further look at their lungs. In other words, they've had a lot of testing to look for typical things that we would worry about, for example, resulting inflammation and scarring that might occur in the lungs or in the heart. And I'll say that the thing that's striking is, at least in my experience so far, most of these patients have normal results on these tests. So I'm at a loss to explain their shortness of breath or their chest pain in many cases. And that's the part that's so disturbing, both to me and to the patients, of course.
Wow. So it doesn't show up on the normal scans and X-rays and CAT scans or whatever you might do, Dr. Kaminsky, but they say, look, I'm still short of breath. Help me out.
That's right. And so I think a couple of things we can offer as physicians. First of all, I let them know right up front, listen, I'm at a loss to explain your symptoms based on conventional testing. Number one is to recognize their symptoms are real. And number two is to try to focus on symptom control itself. So obviously pain relievers, heat, low levels of exercise, meditation and relaxation, anything to try to help them deal with the symptoms themselves, I think is very important. And then we have developed a support group here at University of Vermont, and I know, again, elsewhere throughout the world, such groups exist, and this can help a lot, too, because people need to realize they're not alone in experiencing these things.
Why don't you give us the name of that support group, Dr. Kaminsky, for our Vermont listeners? That's really important.
We don't have a specific name other than the UVM Medical Center COVID Support Group.
Okay, great. And Dr. Maley, I'm struck by what Dr. Kaminsky says. You know, these patients still are having breathing difficulty. He tries to figure it out. Everything looks normal, but they're still struggling. What are you seeing with COVID-19 patients who, you know, had breathing problems, maybe were placed on ventilators? What's the difference between those patients and sort of non-COVID patients?
Yeah, I think I completely agree with Dr. Kaminsky. We're seeing the same thing here and around the world. And I think there are a few pieces to it. In people kind of separating those who had been in the intensive care unit, we've known for a while that recovering from that is difficult because of how sick people got because they're on these medications to make them sleep through their illness. And so they become weak during that period. And because of how sick they were, they naturally have some longer recovery. But then separating that from what we're seeing uniquely with COVID-19, I think a lot of the long-term issues with people who did not have to be in the hospital yet have this sense of brain fog and a difficulty with remembering things and feeling like they previously were very sharp and had some high functioning job, and now it's very difficult to return to that. Those types of things are more unique in terms of other diseases that, say, for example, influenza, that might cause you to feel sick at home, but you didn't have to go to the hospital, and you generally weren't left with this very long lingering problem that had a huge impact on your quality of life. And we're seeing similar things with shortness of breath, which isn't necessarily from something we can explain in the lungs, but is from other causes that cause the same sensation of not being able to breathe comfortably.
Well, there's still so much that we don't know 10 months in. And I have a bunch more questions, but I want to remind our listeners that you can join us 800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the long-term impacts of COVID-19 and why some patients struggle long after they're declared virus-free. Again, join us with your questions or personal experiences. It's 800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook. Again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Dr. Kaminsky, who is most likely to end up, you know, in those worst case scenarios that we hear about, in the hospital, on a ventilator? Is it necessarily people who have had lung problems or lung damage before?
No, not necessarily. We do know now with, as you say, 10 months of experience, that people at risk are definitely older people in their 70s and 80s. People who have underlying comorbid or coexisting conditions like heart disease or lung disease or diabetes, they tend to do worse with the virus and then accordingly are the ones more likely to end up in intensive care. But having said that, we also see otherwise young, healthy people who end up with severe problems with breathing and oxygen and require intensive care primarily for the oxygen support. So it's been quite shocking that way. As far as the long-term symptoms go, some statistics are suggesting that it seems to be more common in women than men, and it seems to be people only in their 40s, who that's the most common age where we find these lingering long-term symptoms we've been talking about. So as was mentioned before, we're really seeing things in quite a different light from typical influenza or other illnesses that require people to be in intensive care.
I'm struck by this image that you gave us earlier, Dr. Kaminsky, of, you know, the patient coming to you weeks, months after their first diagnosis and saying, hey, I'm still having struggles breathing. You do the standard, you know, looks and tests. You don't find anything. You say, I believe you. I want to help you, but I'm not sure what's going on. Where else do you look, Dr. Kaminsky, for, you know, for the source of the trouble?
Well, shortness of breath itself is a very complex symptom. It's not only related to the lungs, but to the heart, to the muscles, to hormonal changes in the body. There are many, many different things that can cause that symptom per se. So we do try to explore all of those factors and make sure we're not missing anything in that regard. The emotional devastation that occurs to someone who's been in intensive care can linger a long time. As Dr. Maley is mentioning, that's a very important component of recovery from critical illness in general. And sometimes the manifestations of those lingering effects are symptoms like shortness of breath, headaches, chest pain that really aren't explained on a typical biological basis. It's not to say that they're not real. They're very real, but they're somehow driven by underlying conditions related to stress, anxiety, unexplained things that we really don't understand at this point.
Sure, and it kind of spirals, I'm guessing, because if there's these unexplained things, including shortness of breath, which must be incredibly scary, that just, you know, kind of spirals it downward. You get more anxious. I'm interested in something you said too, Dr. Kaminsky. You said you tend to see, you know, the surprising patients are women in their 40s, and you also mentioned hormonal changes might be a factor here. You know, 40s and early 50s are when many women go through menopause. I wonder if that's something you're looking at.
People have talked about that, trying to understand why there may be a difference between men and women in this regard. Autoimmune diseases in general are more common in women than men, just across the board. And so people have been looking for many years trying to figure that out, and hormonal effects might be part of that. With regard to other hormonal issues and shortness of breath, I was thinking of things, for example, like low thyroid conditions that can sometimes result in shortness of breath. So there are subtle other changes in the body. Anemia is another one that we have to keep a lookout for in terms of explaining someone's shortness of breath.
Dr. Maley, I'd love your thoughts, too, on what Dr. Kaminsky is seeing.
Yes, I think we're seeing the same thing in many ways, that some patients, but uncommonly, come in feeling short of breath. And they do have an issue with their lungs that we can identify. They were very sick and they have some scarring or changes in their lungs. But that's pretty uncommon compared to the people who feel short of breath after COVID, but don't have an identifiable change in their lungs. And so we try to focus on just the things that Dr. Kaminsky mentioned, as well as the need for intensive rehabilitation and people working with physical therapists and recovery centers to build back up their muscle strength, their exercise abilities. I kind of liken it to athletes training that, unfortunately, it's a long haul, but we can, with perseverance and partnering with patients, try to get them back to their quality of life and really work on what their goals are.
Here's a specific question for you, Dr. Maley, and I'm sure you've gotten this from patients. So, you know, the types of help that you're offering, rehab, physical therapy, visits with you, all that costs money. And I wonder how insurance is viewing, you know, paying for people who need all this extra treatment without a specific diagnosis. You know, you can't point to something on their scan and say, voila, there's the problem. I mean, are you able to file for post-COVID syndrome for your patients so they can get coverage for all these services?
Well, that's a great point. Insurance is, and coverage for this is always one of the challenges, and people have limits to the amount of rehabilitation services they can get. For patients who feel short of breath and who we can find some good way to describe it and justify it, we haven't had any problems getting them the services. I think part of it is also with COVID-19, receiving services in person is tough. Yeah. I would say the patients that I talk to universally who have had COVID-19 are very vigilant about distancing and masking, and have, in many ways, they become advocates in their communities for people taking this as seriously as possible. So they're not themselves also kind of eager to go out into the world. We do our clinic via telemedicine, via video or telephone, so that it's convenient for people. But then the physical services, patients often come in person to work with the physical therapists.
Well, both of you, we're hearing from listeners, so let's go to them. And again, our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And then our number is 800-892-6477. And both of you, Ellen is calling from Concord. Hi, Ellen. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a local voice teacher and opera singer, and I am nervous in my tachycardia now that I have postventricular contractions, and I'm checking into POTS syndrome as well. Having been a long hauler of COVID, I got it in March, and I noticed that I'm getting feedback. Sorry, so I'm having a hard time hearing.
And have you turned your radio down, Ellen?
Yeah.
Did you turn your radio down?
It's not on.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, go ahead.
Anyway,
we're managing.
Okay, sorry. Well, back in March, I felt as if I was having a mammogram on my lungs, and I had all the symptoms. I went to the emergency room, and I had fever, everything, and was sent home. And it's taken me this long to be able to sing and teach. But I am looking for recommendations for, I'm so glad to hear Dr. Maley saying there's telemedicine to Boston, but if there are any New Hampshire programs where we can have recommended rehab, because I am a vocal athlete. I do have shows coming up in the summer. I know that what saved me from COVID was being forced to get up and march in place for a minute at a time to get my strength back, because COVID was, it felt as if it was infiltrating like Nagini in Harry Potter in my lungs.
Wow.
But I am a singer, and I normally have 42 students a week singing at me point blank range at four different institutions. And no wonder I'm a petri dish for them. but thankfully I can continue through online, but I've only managed to work up to 28 students a week, and but I'm getting there. But I,
Ellen, I'm so glad to hear your story and that you're doing well. But I'm sorry you struggled so much. And you know, I'm a Harry Potter fan, so I know what you mean about Nagini in the lungs. That's an image there. I think I'll turn to you, Dr. Kaminsky. You know, she first got COVID-19 back in March, and that does seem to be a theme that we hear from other patients just doing the reading around this. What does that imply to you, Dr. Kaminsky? Just that people were less careful back in March because they didn't know, or that the strain back in March was actually tougher? Do we know that?
No, I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think it's simply that, you know, COVID took us all by surprise.
And lots
of people got sick in March and April. Testing was not widespread at the time, and so a lot of people did not have documented infection based on nasal swabs, but were presumed to have COVID based on their clinical presentation. And I totally agree that most of them probably indeed had COVID. But what we're hearing is a very common story of people who were sick that long ago who still have lingering symptoms. Regarding the voice, that's a very important point. You need a lot of lung strength to sing and speak, and the vocal cords themselves are made of muscles, and so it's important that to recognize that they also can be affected by this illness. And so one thing I'd recommend for her in particular is to seek out a speech and language pathology or a voice therapist or a speech therapist in her community that might be helpful to her.
Oh, and yeah, so frustrating because Ellen makes her living singing, and I'm sure she's passionate about it. So that's tough. Ellen, thank you for calling in, and good luck to you. And you also asked about resources here in New Hampshire. Ellen, we will put resources about these post-COVID clinics helping people with long-term COVID symptoms on our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Dr. Kaminsky, last question for you, please. How has treating these long-term COVID patients change the way that physicians like you understand or look at the body, disability, and just long-term systemic illnesses?
Well, that's a great question. I think we've all been tremendously humbled by this. You know, we see sick people all the time in critical care. We tend to get them through their illness if we're able to, and then they have a recovery period, and it kind of follows a frustrating course, but one that's rather well-defined. But here, nothing's defined well. There's so much uncertainty still. And so I know that when I hear these stories from patients, I'm extremely humbled by them and realize how much we don't know. And I'm grateful that around the world, people are dedicating resources to this. I think ultimately we're going to learn a lot, and we're going to have a much better appreciation of how viral illnesses in particular can affect the body, the entire body, all of its organs, and what the subtle features can be regarding symptoms like we've been describing, shortness of breath, fatigue, and so on, that don't clearly have a single source, but are related to multiple complex factors that, again, we're just learning about.
Well, Dr. Kaminsky, it's been really good to talk to you, and good luck as you continue to treat these patients, and I hope you join us again.
Thank you so much, Laura. Take care.
That's Dr. David Kaminsky, pulmonary and critical care physician at the University of Vermont Medical Center and medical director of the Pulmonary Function Laboratory. Well, coming up, we'll hear from the founder of a support group for people with long-term COVID symptoms. And we'll keep taking your calls. It's 800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And again, we will be updating our website with information about Dr. Kaminsky and Dr. Maley's work. Also, we'll hear about, we'll put the information for the support group up there as well. Our website is nhpr.org/exchange, and we will be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the plight of those patients known as long haulers, people who suffer from a range of physical and mental health symptoms long after they're declared COVID-free. Listeners, if you have experience with this yourself or questions about what this means, send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with Dr. Jason Maley. He works with COVID patients with long-term problems and specializes in pulmonary disease on the Harvard Medical Faculty at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And joining us now is Diana Barrett, creator of Survivor Corps, a movement supporting and mobilizing supporters of COVID-19, also supporting research into recovery. And Diana Barrett, it's really nice to have you. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Well, and both of you, lots of reaction from our listeners. So let's go right to them. Kat is calling from Torrington, Connecticut. Hi, Kat. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Laura. I am a longtime listener. Thank you so much.
This
is bringing up such horrible memories for me. COVID struck my family so hard this year. A few of my family members had gotten it back in the spring when everybody else did. And my brother got it in April. And he lives in Utah. He's an avid mountain biker. He's really physically fit. And he would go out and mountain bike 30 miles a day and not even think of it. And he contracted COVID and, got over the initial symptoms and then continued to have breathing problems all summer long. And he couldn't even get on his bike. And it was breaking his heart. You know, he couldn't go out hiking. He couldn't do anything. And so he decided he was just going to push through it. The doctor said it would eventually, just dissipate and he would be fine. But, nobody knows that, it's not something that is known. This thing hasn't been around that long. And so then he was out one day hiking and all of a sudden had a sharp pain in his chest. And that wasn't normal for him either. I mean, he's only 60. He's not that old. So he immediately went to his doctor. They did all kinds of heart tests on him. He had a stress test, and the doctor said, "We have to get you in right away. This is not something that we're going to mess with." And thank heavens he got in when he did. He wound up having a quadruple bypass surgery in October, and he's recovering really well. But we were all a nervous wreck there for a few weeks, not knowing, whether he was going to make it or not. And my sister-in-law sent photographs of him hooked up to, like 20 different machines. And it was very frightening. I went out there for 2 weeks to help in his recovery. And we all rented a cabin in the mountains and we had a really good time as a family, but the poor guy couldn't do anything. He sat in a chair. We cooked for him. We helped him out whenever we could. And
I'm glad to hear your story. And I'm really glad that your brother made it through. I was afraid you were going to tell us that it went the other way. And I want to bring you in, Diana. I'm sure there's a lot there that you can relate to, including, he got over his initial symptoms, but then just felt awful, couldn't go back to his regular level of activity. When were you first diagnosed with COVID-19, Diana, and how serious was your initial period of illness?
So I was one of the first people in the New York area, I'd say one of the first non-healthcare professionals to get a positive PCR test back in March. I was exposed on March 9th at a small meeting. I was 1 degree removed from a super spreader event. And I woke up on Friday the 13th, March 13th, with sort of every symptom in the book. And I stayed in isolation for 18 days. At that point, we had no idea how long one was contagious for. And so I was actually also one of the few people to get tested on the back end of the virus to make sure I was clear of it, as I was the first plasma donor at Columbia University. So I already had my antibodies tested by the end of March, and my entire family had had COVID by the end of March. I had what I like to refer to as the Tylenol and Gatorade variety of COVID, the type where you are given your diagnosis and told best of luck, which is 90% of us. I never had to go to the hospital. Thank God I didn't come close to having to come to the hospital. Of course, I had the fear the entire time because you don't know when it's going to get worse. I was sick, but not in any life-threatening way. So I was very lucky. I thought that I was really much better after those first few weeks. And I felt better for the first couple of months and then had a full symptomatic relapse over the summer ended up with an accidental diagnosis of COVID onset glaucoma, which was sort of shocking. And I have to say, I'm extremely lucky in that it's now 9.5 months later, and I am really pretty much back to myself. But I also feel like I might be in the minority of those people who had lingering symptoms, and they actually did go away. And I also hesitate to even refer to them as lingering symptoms, because they're not necessarily the same symptoms that you experience when you have, I don't even like to call it acute COVID, but contagious COVID. Because now that we understand the vascular nature of the disease and how it affects the endothelial lining of your vasculature, there's not a single organ in your body that doesn't rely on blood flow. And so what we're seeing is not just prolonged symptoms, but actual physical damage to organs. The glaucoma in my eyes, they found evidence of micro blood clots in my eyes. Wow. And fraying of the capillaries. My 11-year-old son had COVID, regular 11-year-old version of COVID last winter. And I never would have called him a long hauler. I would have put him in the recovered category, which is why these metrics are so tricky and not quite helpful, because he was really okay. And, you know, I didn't have anything that I would have mentioned. And it wasn't until 10 months later that he was sitting on the couch watching TV. This was just about 6 weeks ago. And one of his front adult teeth spontaneously fell out with no blood loss, which is turning out to be a not uncommon scenario.
That is creepy, because, Diana.
Yeah, it is really, it is scary. I mean, it is literally the thing of nightmares, because, and it is, you know, from vascular damage, and we're still trying to figure out whether the vascular damage was in the tooth, the gums, or the jaw.
This is so important, and I'm so glad you mentioned vascular disease, because Dr. Maley, you know, early on, again, this is part of this evolving narrative of COVID. Early on, we thought, okay, it's a lung disease. And if you have healthy lungs and you're basically a healthy person, you probably recover fine. Why is this vascular issue that Diana is raising so important for people to understand?
Yes. So first, thanks, Diana, for coming. I'm really glad that she's here. And that story is pretty incredible, especially what happened to her son just suddenly 10 months later. I think the vascular aspect of COVID has been something people are continuing to explore. And like Diana alluded to, if the lining of your blood vessels were affected, or the blood vessels themselves, or blood clotting, then that could affect any part of your body. The entire body relies on that. And so these issues like the eye-related issues, glaucoma or tooth or other unusual things that come up months, 9 months, 10 months after you've been sick, are, I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg and just beginning to understand this. I'll say when people were very sick in the ICU, there were a lot of thoughts about if you could treat them with medications that affect blood clotting. Those have been studied in a few studies so far, and haven't panned out as helping patients. So that's what's so tricky about this is, we've seen people become very sick in the ICU before with oxygen issues with their oxygen levels, but COVID is panning out to be in many ways different than what we expected, and especially these long-term, long-haul issues with COVID.
Yeah. Let's take some more calls. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Diana.
I was just going to say that it's very interesting because you and I are seeing two very different populations, and so it's very interesting to compare notes. He's seeing the hospitalized, and I'm seeing, you know, obviously I'm not a doctor, just want to be clear, but I am seeing those who are not hospitalized, never given an anticoagulant or an anti-interferon or anything else. And those people coming up with the clear lung scans, not, you know, 6-9 months later, and are still having tightness of chest and shortness of breath, we're now actually sort of next generation imaging on those CAT scans, And when we're able to look at the vast, the sort of the finest airwaves, the Dr. Mailey will have to fill me in on the exact terms of those, but those fine bronchial tubes, that they are destroyed by an average case of COVID. I have a friend who is my age, I am the average age of a COVID long hauler, I'm a 46-year-old woman. So I have a friend who's exactly my age. She lives on the West Coast. She had COVID exactly when we got sick on the same day, ironically.
Oh my gosh.
Same kind of, you know, Tylenol and Gatorade. And she just had, she went for a lung CAT scan, this sort of second generation imaging on that CAT scan, and they were able to see that she had 40% reduced lung capacity. They were able to look at, you know, the and more detailed imaging.
You know, I want to bring in our listeners because I know they have a lot to share, and we'll definitely follow up on that point too, sort of what we're seeing when we look down at the finest lines. So back to the phones for a moment, and this is Kathy in Nashua. Kathy, thank you for calling The Exchange. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm calling about my my son, who is 30, and he got COVID last April, and he was a pharmacy tech, and he had a lot of people coming in that had COVID that would walk in and hand him prescriptions with no masks, et cetera, and so he caught it, and he was fairly sick. He ended up in the emergency room a few times for breathing difficulties, but he was never ventilated or anything, and he now has basically symptoms of CFS. He can't walk across a room. He can't work. He gets dizzy standing for any length of time. He's almost to the point of bedridden. He's pretty much housebound. He can't walk to his car without having to stop several times and rest. And he's, you know, he was in Texas. He was living in an apartment on a third floor apartment, and we ended up moving him back here with us because obviously that's something that he couldn't do. And now we're stuck, and we don't know where to go from here. He's been to the doctors. They've tested him for pretty much everything, and everything's coming back negative. So any suggestions that
Kathy, thank you for calling, and I'm so sorry to hear about your son. 30 is really young. Dr. Mailey, you know, you're in Boston, so you maybe not connected with New Hampshire providers, but just in general, what does a patient do when they've been, as Kathy says, tested for everything, everything comes back negative, and yet her son feels crappy? He really can't survive on his own.
Yeah, no, thanks for calling, Kathy. This is a really, really challenging issue that a lot of people are facing after COVID. And I think what Kathy mentioned, chronic fatigue syndrome, is something that has been seen in people after other types of infections in the past. And so we are kind of drawing some connections between those types of symptoms, which are just sudden exhaustion, not being able to do anything throughout the day, this feeling of dizziness or the room spinning around you, having your heart race or feeling like it's beating out of your chest. We're seeing aspects of that with COVID. One of the toughest things is knowing then what to do next. First, we make sure that they're not explained by something more clear, like a change in the blood count level or issues with the lungs or other things. And then once all of those things have been excluded by carefully testing, then we're left with first acknowledging we don't know, but we are partners with the patients, and we're not going to abandon them. And they have now a growing community of people who are trying to solve these problems. We work with rehabilitation specialists to try to build up people's activity levels. There's something called pacing that's done in chronic fatigue syndrome, which is just based around the idea that people can push themselves and then have to recover for 3 days. And that cycle really isn't healthy for building up your strength. So rather coming up with a very specific pacing regimen where you slowly improve your abilities each day, but you never have that crash and burn cycle. We work with neurologists to make sure that the feeling of dizziness and the room spinning isn't related to any issue that's affected the brain itself, but is just our sense of balance. And there are therapies that physical therapists do for people who have that sensation.
So that's the kind
unfortunately,
of,
there's no magic bullet.
That's the kind of care then that is, you know, given by a, you know, a facility such as yours, where you are specifically focused on COVID patients. It's sort of that comprehensive look, Dr. Mealy. That sounds like it's what people like Kathy's son need. I know I asked you this before, but again, does insurance basically say, okay, Kathy's son, you have post-COVID syndrome, if that's the official term, and you can access all this?
Patients should be able to access these things. Yeah, I don't think, at least initially, there should be issues for people. And just insurance coverage alone is a huge issue. We could have an entire radio program dedicated to it.
But, weeks and weeks of programming on that. I wonder what Diana is hearing.
There should be initial coverage.
Yeah. I wonder what you're hearing, Diana, from other members of Survivor Corps about their ability to get insurance coverage for this.
That is definitely a tricky issue, and the naming of this, I know it's come up a few times so far in this conversation, but as I say, you know, the naming of the disease is a delicate matter, and we don't have a name yet. I actually don't love the term post-COVID syndrome because, as far as I'm concerned, we don't quite yet understand the etiology of the virus well enough yet to say that it's post-anything. We're still finding the virus remaining in the gut, in periodontal pockets, in the ear canal, in various parts of the body. So we don't quite know that it's post anything. And syndrome seems to suggest that we don't understand where it's coming from, and we understand, but it's coming from the COVID virus. We're not quite sure about the mechanism of everything that it's doing to the body, but people are hungry for help. And they are having difficulty finding help because they are not often being believed by their doctors. They are often being given diagnoses of anxiety when they are actually experiencing things like tachycardia, where they need to see a cardiologist. People are having real physical manifestations and real difficulty, as you can see from all of these examples, and to be told that you're anxious and depressed and that is the source can, you know, really drive a person to madness. excuse me. On the Survivor Corps website, survivorcorps.com, that's CORPS, we have a national map where you can click on the post-COVID care center in this wherever you live to find the one closest to you. And we are advocating for opening them around the country, and we are drawing up blueprints for what we think the model system should look like and what it needs to include.
Wow. All right. So, Kathy, I hope you're still listening. We'll have that information on our website from Diana's group where you can look around and maybe find more resources. And let me just express my hopes that your son recovers. Thank you for calling, and we'll hear from a lot more of you after a short break. Again, our number is 800-892-6477. I have some emails I'd like to get to, too. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be back in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, what we know and what we don't about the impacts of COVID-19 long after infection. More patients are reporting they don't feel fully recovered, suffering from an array of ailments some call post-COVID syndrome. Listeners, if you have questions about this or you've experienced it yourself, let's hear from you. Our email exchange@nhpr.org, comment on Facebook, or call us 800-892-6477. Our guests are Dr. Jason Mealy, a physician, researcher, and professor who works with COVID-19 patients with long-term symptoms. Also with us, Diana Barrett, a COVID-19 patient and founder of the support group Survivor Corps. And Diana Barrett, you were kind of going there after the break, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about some of the frustrations that all the people who are part of this Survivor Corps that you have built are expressing to you. Diana, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, I can. Oh, Diana, great to have you. Yes.
Okay. So one of the things that you were referring to before were the many people who were not able to get tested in the spring. And those who were able to get tested often had faulty testing. The antibody testing in the early months was quite inaccurate. You know, and so there is also a hurdle of having to prove that you had COVID. And one of the answer to that is coming very soon. It's actually available now. It will be officially launched in a couple of weeks, but you can actually get the test now. It's a T-cell test from Adaptive Biotechnologies. And the test is called T-Detect. And T-cells show up before antibodies, and they last longer than antibodies. And it will be a much more accurate reflection on whether or not you did indeed have a COVID infection and whether your body launched a natural immune response to it. So that is very good news. That's here right now and just now available for patients. So that will be a big help. But we really need these centers, you know, everywhere. And we need an understanding and a standard of care. I think that one of the, you know, real things that are missing is that, you know, as opposed to Dr. Maley's patients who get therapeutics in the hospital, people who have the Tylenol and Gatorade variety like me don't get anything. So where as in other countries, when you are diagnosed with COVID, you are given a package of therapeutics immediately. Our first line of defense is the emergency room. And I think that that needs to change because there are probably things right off the shelf that we can be advising people to take that will slow down the progression of the disease and the damage to the organs in the aftermath.
Wow, that's really interesting. And I have to go to you, Dr. Maley. I am wondering about medicines, treatments that, you know, as Diana says, can be given right off the shelf for people who don't go to the hospital for COVID, but, you know, struggle in the initial phases, and as Diana's telling us, struggle long after.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. Also, just thinking about treating COVID with the aim of preventing these long-term issues, rather than the things that are measured, which are if patients survive or how fast patients' symptoms, the initial symptoms improve when they were first infectious. And that's something that hasn't been done broadly in medicine well, even before COVID, studying medications and treatments for people who are sick with the aim that it's not just about surviving, but about improving the long-term effects. That's something that's part of studies that are ongoing, but because they're long-term effects, we don't get that information until people have been infected long enough after receiving the treatment. I don't know currently of anything that we've proven to benefit patients long-term once they recover and prevent these long COVID issues, but that's a great point and something that we're looking at.
Well, when President Trump got COVID, Dr. Maley, you know, he recovered quickly. Obviously, he had top care there at, you know, Walter Reed Medical Center, but he did talk about a couple medicines that he took that he said, you know, he wanted all Americans to have access to, that these were great, that these were a quote unquote cure. Are there medications that, you know, the president took that could provide hope for other Americans who, you know, either struggle with long-term symptoms now or are afraid that they will get long-term symptoms?
Yeah, so largely what they were referring to and what the options are antibodies, which are things that help attack and clear infections in your body and can either be taken from other people who have been infected. That's convalescent plasma that Diana mentioned, people who have had COVID and then donate their blood. And we take those antibodies and we use them for treatment. Or companies have come up with their own antibodies that they've created to attack COVID. Bamlanivimab is one that's received authorization for emergency use. And so these are things that are currently being used, although the exact benefit isn't completely clear who's the best person to give it to. But the focus right now is on people who have symptoms that don't necessarily require them being in the hospital and or require them being in the intensive care unit. So that's antibodies are what they were referring to. And I would say in the case of people you see in the media who have varying recoveries, it's so hard to say because that could just be the case. We didn't, you know, we don't know what the world would have looked like had that person not received those treatments. So it's hard to compare one person to another, but the antibody treatments are the main ones that were kind of publicized for the president.
Wow. Well, let's take another call. This is Barbara in Tamworth. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you. I have two questions. First of all, my issue is sounds similar to some of the long-term effects, but they go back way over a year. I'm a hiker. I'm pretty just turned 70, but I'm in pretty good health, very good health. And when I get out hiking, even a year ago, was noticing this shortness of breath. I had my general health checkup for the year, and everything's fine. No issues with the lungs that they could see or hear. So it's just sort of this big question mark. But I'd say it's gotten a little worse over time, and I've started getting some heart palpitations or things, you know, where I can feel the strong pulse in my head or whatever. Anyway, so my questions are, if it's possible that some of this virus stuff was around before the beginning of last year. I know I've heard of people who had it in January or February, but maybe even longer than that, some of similar to COVID but not recognized as COVID. And the second question is, with these people who are in long-term care, I just missed the part about antibodies, so maybe you answered it, but is there, you know, how do tests for COVID come up? Does it show as positive in the long term? You know, if you actually were infected 6 months ago.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah, Barbara, two great questions. Thank you. And we're getting towards the end of the show, so I'll let you go, but I do want to ask those questions. First of all, you know, the testing has been a big source of frustration, Diana. I know for you. How long do you know, Diana, do those antibodies show up in the blood? I mean, you know, Barbara's wondering, could she have gotten this late last year?
The chances are is that, Barbara, unfortunately, probably you no longer have antibodies if you had it over a year ago. Mm. There is no definitive answer yet just because not enough time has passed. And what's interesting is we're not seeing a direct correlation between severity of sickness and longevity of antibodies. It seems to be fairly random. It could be genetic. There's a theory that people of Asian descent have a higher count of antibodies and carry them longer. It's unclear. I had them until November. I still have antibodies. It's just not high enough to count on it. I don't have a high enough concentration or titer level to show up on a commercial test anymore, but you still retain some number of antibodies, but the memory is kept in your T cells and B cells in order to produce them. So that's where the long-term, any potential long-term immunity stands. But if you have had COVID and you do have antibodies, and especially if you have a high count of antibodies, please go and donate your plasma. Every donation, it can save 3 to 4 lives. It's National Blood Month. If you don't have antibodies, your blood is needed no matter what. Whole blood, platelets, whatever you have to give. 1 out of 3 COVID patients in the hospital right now in America is receiving convalescent plasma. Mm. And the number would be higher if the supply was higher. So
that's interesting.
I cannot urge people enough.
Well, and there's a picture of you, Diana, you know, holding up your bag of plasma. So is that another treatment, Dr. Malley, that, you know, COVID patients can look forward to so that they don't suffer some of these long-term symptoms that Diana's told us about?
Yes. So convalescent plasma, this idea of taking what people who have been infected, their bodies produce to fight off the virus and giving it through blood donation to other patients who are getting infected. That's one of the treatments that's being used for COVID-19, mainly for people, not for people very sick in the intensive care unit, but for people who may not be in the hospital or are in the hospital, but not as sick in terms of their oxygen levels. And that's the same idea of these other medications that are being produced to create antibodies, kind of synthetic in a lab, an antibody in a lab rather than through donation.
I had one thing on the monoclonal antibodies. These sort of manufactured antibodies, they do need to be given within 72 hours of diagnosis, which is very tricky logistically because most people are not in the hospital yet within 72 hours of diagnosis. So in terms of exactly, and it's a transfusion, so it's not a pill that you can take at home. It does have to be done under medical supervision. So there is really sort of a logistical obstacle to actually getting your hands on these fabricated antibodies.
Well, and we could have talked a lot more, and I do want to let listeners know, if we didn't get to your question, we do have resources on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. We will have to revisit this topic again because we've got to wrap it up for now. Dr. Maley, it was really great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for coming on, Diana.
That's Dr. Jason Maley. He specializes in pulmonary disease on the Harvard Medical Faculty at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, where he directs the COVID-19 Survivorship Program. And Diana Barrett, thank you for sharing your story, and thank you for being with us on the air today, too. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on. Best of health. Bye-bye.
That's Diana Barrett, creator of Survivor Corps, a COVID-19 recovery support program. Today's show was produced by Exchange producer Christina Phillips. Thanks for being with us. This is NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.